This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 27th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello, and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24, with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we look to the future in Israel, we look to the past in Berlin, and we go to Hong Kong to see how the old and the new blend very nicely indeed. Monocle's Joseph Dana discusses an exhibition in Tel Aviv that visualises what peace could look like for Israel and Palestine, and how architecture can help the conflict.
It's about architectics. Not about the architecture. It's about how you turn your design skills and what you know best how to do to change the world around you.
We'll head to Toronto to meet a horticulturalist who turns his hand to furniture making when he's not protecting his city's greenery from insects, pollution, and vandals.
You walk into the cooler and these eerie, organic, tree-like shapes will be glowing from within. So it's kind of an eerie, organic feel, but still hinting at functional lighting.
Plus, we head to Scotland to meet a set of architectural graduates that's encouraging the industry to get its hands dirty and get to grips with the basics of building. That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. We begin in Israel. Architects and designers are often tempted to say that design can change the way we think about the world and society. While that reality might be fleeting for many in the design world, one Jerusalem architecture firm is trying to break the deadlock between Israel and Palestine with design. Saya Architecture is the brainchild of Israeli architects Yehuda Grenfield Gilat and Karen Lee Bar-Sinai. With a new exhibition in Tel Aviv, Saya is using architecture and design to help people on the ground visualise what peace could look like. Monocle's Joseph Dana sat down with the architects in a cafe outside of the old city of Jerusalem to find out more about how they believe architecture can help solve one of the world's most entrenched conflicts. Joseph began by asking Karen to describe a recent visualisation of a future border crossing between Palestinian and Israeli Jerusalem that was featured in The New Yorker.
One of the main contributions we believe that architects can have to resolving the conflict is really showing how peace could and should look like. You mentioned the article in The New Yorker. I think what captures people's minds when you show them a 3D rendering of how a crossing, a border crossing might look like, how the city might transform from this conflict to a peaceful reality, to a natural, functioning, viable urban reality of two capitals living side by side, it really convinces you that there's might be something to hope for rather than fear. And we were very fortunate that that drawing actually served Prime Minister Olmert and Abbas in 2008 in the Annapolis negotiations. And we personally feel that the presence of an architectural detail at that level, you know, a leader-to-leader discussion, it's where you draw the broad strokes. It's not where you talk about the details. So the presence of architecture there is very noteworthy because it means it can shape the way decisions are made about space, not only space itself, where architects are usually associated with their impact.
So I would be very curious to know how you arrived at looking at the conflict from such a strongly kind of two-state, almost traditional way of looking at the peace process, as opposed to adopting some of the newer ideas regarding one state and how that might look from an architectural standpoint. Was that just a political decision, or was that an architectural decision saying this is the kind of framework that's been accepted by the international community and therefore we should look at it?
I mean, it's a personal opinion, but I believe that we share it in Saya. The basis to our activity is ideological. It means that we do believe that the only viable solution to this conflict would be some sort of independence of Palestinians and a sovereign Palestinian state. And therefore, all of our practice is driven from that basic assumption. we see architecture as a problem-solving, profession. So the problem here comes from the politics. It's not that we are charmed by a kind of fascinating architectural scheme and then we try to fit our political ideology to it. It's the other way around. We believe that there needs to be a two-state solution. There is a need for a Palestinian state living in peace and security by Israel, which with Jerusalem, East Jerusalem as its capital. And therefore, our question is, how do we make this happen? Or how do we help others who are involved in this issue make it easier for them to make the right decision about it? I'm not saying that we are not thinking about other scenarios and how these come to life architecturally, but in general, the level of politics is usually the one that sets, the trajectory of what we do. And I think it makes sense.
You have so much to look at on the ground here in Israel-Palestine, especially in Jerusalem. Do you look at other contexts, other examples worldwide for inspiration, for some new type of thinking to apply here when you're thinking about architecture and the conflict?
We're also involved in Cyprus. We're starting to be involved in the Balkans. And maybe Cyprus is a good example because what happened there was, I don't have to describe the situation, also the Greeks and the Turks. But what's important is that Kofi Annan, the General Secretary of the UN, was submitting a peace proposal a few years ago that went to a referendum and was rejected. And if you look into that referendum and what it suggests, it has a very nice, very, very clear concept of a confederation with the Supreme Court and, all the institutions in the middle. But what it lacks is a real serious approach to the territorial problem, which is actually the pain of the people on both sides. People there, like here, were moved from their place. There's a problem of settlements, a problem of refugees. All of these are real issues there. And that proposal does not relate to these issues at all. It's very technical in the sense how the solution has to work like. And we believe that if an architect or someone who has sensitive to space was part of crafting that solution, it wouldn't look like that. And maybe in many ways the referendum was accepted by the Greek side.
I think we often are asked the question whether our resolution planning, whether our approach is exportable and implementable in other conflicts. And we certainly say yes to that, because if you try to formulate what we're trying to do is to get policymakers think more like architects. So we don't use the architectural detail for the usual used to build something, but rather to craft or influence or in a way shape a little bit to the better the decisions taken about space. And in conflicted territories where there's conflict, often there's such a great gap between this really broad stroke of the policy making and the ground, and there is where we fit in. So yes, in any place where there's conflict, we certainly see ourselves involved. And I must say, this needn't be only a territorial conflict. It could be, cities around us have conflicts in many, many other social, political levels. So it can be that as well.
I often hear from architects and designers that they believe that they're actually changing the world, and that the proper design of a chair or the proper design of a table can influence world happiness, as it were. How would you answer that question? Do you believe that you're actually changing the world with some of this architectural thinking that you're doing?
Definitely. Yes. I'm skeptical about the fact that a chair or a building can change a very complex problem, sophisticated problem. But I do believe that the role of architects is yet to be defined. The new role. The old role of creating built environments and influencing neighborhoods is well known. It's very relevant to some aspects of our lives, but I believe that architecture has much more to offer. It's a profession that's sensitive to the connections between people and space. And in that sense, it could influence policymakers as much as it could influence a neighborhood. And in that sense, it may be even the influence is even stronger and more dominant, and I'd say even more important in many ways. This is what we believe. We also try to design buildings, but we feel that what we do now, designing ideas that can change the world, that can bring peace, is at least as important, if not even more.
It's not reducing the mission of a designer. We truly believe, we truly feel as designers and as architects, every morning we wake up, we think, how do we make our the world around us a better place? So this sense of mission isn't reduced, but it's really about using your skills in a very, very different way, in a very strategic way. And if you wish, that's what the exhibition is about. It's about architectics, not about the architecture. It's about how you turn your design skills and what you know best how to do to change the world around you.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Lots more coming up, including a Hong Kong-based design firm making new out of the old. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. This August in Berlin, interior architect Gisbert Poppler and vintage furniture dealer Eric Hofstetter have taken over a former 19th century hardware store at the historic Wallstrasse 85. There they have created a sophisticated choreography of interior architecture, fine art and boutique home furnishings. Monocle's Melanie Sevchenko attended the exhibition to get a feel for the opulent and the ornate, with design elements dating from 1900 to the present day.
The dilapidated interior of the historic building at Wallstrasse 85 is teeming with lavish spirit, summoned from layers of history. Exposed concrete walls cradle a constellation of decadent adornments, restored vintage furniture, and vibrant carpeted terrains. This is Between Time, a sumptuous collection of magnificent still life tableaux curated by interior designer Gisbert Poppler and vintage furniture aficionado Eric Hofstetter. All the design objects were produced specifically for the show in a mixture of new and restored.
We have the old vintage pieces and also old Chinese carpets, the Art Deco carpets, old chandeliers from Venini, from an insurance company in Wiesbaden, where Eric has his gallery. And that is mainly what I do as an interior architect for my clients.
Gisbert Poppler has been working in the industry of interior architecture for decades, but says one reason for having the show is to bring his craft into the public sphere.
What we also want to do here that is really important about this show, we want to introduce interior design in Germany, because in America, in England, in France, there is a long tradition for interior design. In Germany, it's more that you do your own home concept. You do not ask for an interior designer. In New York, you have your psychiatrist and you have your interior designer. So we want to show what it can mean to work with an interior designer, also to show that it doesn't have to look like you worked with somebody, that it's not like one style and you are completely, as the owner, you are completely out. That's what many people fear. They fear, if I take an interior designer and ask him, my apartment will be something from him, but not from myself.
As a pioneer of interior design in Berlin, Poppler has been a longtime collaborator of Eric Hofstetter, a vanguard in his respective field. For Hofstetter, collaborating with Poppler is a chance to become fully immersed in aesthetic.
He has a beautiful sense for details, and he's never doing the same show. He's always finding out what his client wants to have, what they need, and he works for them, and he doesn't have a special way of making colors, lights, furniture, and every client gets the same.
Hofstetter is now based in Wiesbaden, but found his vintage legs in Berlin.
I restored especially vintage design because there was no one in Berlin who tried to go new ways in the view on restoration. So I had a a lot of clients who were collecting vintage design, Asian art, African art, also antique furniture, Baroque, Biedermeier, Klassizismus, but they were not happy with their restorers. And I was the one going new ways, who was accepting that a furniture, or who showed them that a furniture must have patina to be a special piece.
With Between Time, Popler and Hofstetter broke away from the conventions of the typical showroom monoculture and hand-selected a pastiche of partners, including Etsuchana, Italy's premier furniture manufacturer, with restored pieces from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Didar, for the latest collection of fabrics and wall coverings, and exclusive access to selected pieces in Wallstrasse 85, provided by Christmann Immobilien. All design elements span the gamut of time across two centuries. The space itself is indeed a piece of the collection, a longtime favorite among architects in Berlin, and featured only in a handful of select high-profile events. Wallstrasse 85 stands shrouded in mystery as one of the few remaining buildings of such grandeur. Yet it faces inevitable gentrification. Scheduled for complete renovation in the near future, the ground floor of Wallstrasse 85 will be used as a commercial art space, while the remaining floors will be converted into flats. The Between the Time showcase will be one of the final opportunities for the public to enjoy its raw splendor. Standing on one of the exhibition's vintage carpets is Amin Motamedi, interior designer and carpet connoisseur.
Normally people in Germany are not very familiar with carpets, not anymore. This is a try to show the people that carpets, especially very classic carpets, can be cool. Most of the stuff we have is really old. I mean, the big carpets, this one and the two others, are Chinese Art Deco carpets made for the American market back in the 30s. And the rest are kilims, so flat weaves, nomadic pieces from Iran, from Turkey, so for very simple housing, but fitting very well to modern furniture, since they have very basic designs like stripes or geometric designs.
Popler and Hofstetter also pluck design pearls from artists with whose work they have a personal relationship. Remo V. Lotano provided collages and assemblage, an art form he's been cultivating since the Iron Curtain dissolved.
When I got to Berlin in the early 90s, they just started renovating a lot of the buildings in East Berlin. And they were just gutting them and throwing everything out. And people had left right after the wall, and they just left everything behind. And so I was finding these objects that had the patina from years of use that had been once very important to people, but were just trash now. And I started collecting them because the history of the pieces excited me. And then I would create these, what I find as aesthetically pleasing, compositions with them.
He stands over two floor pieces that are deconstructed children's sleighs.
Like these two here, I call them the Swiss weapons of minimal destruction. They're the runners of sleds, and I've taken off the part that somebody lays on, and I've made them, brought them in together so that they're very thin, and I've attached old ski poles that are probably 100 years old because they're made out of bamboo with leather and almost like wrought iron spikes on them.
Right.
And then I used some springs from an old mattress to give them that technical look, and they just, there's a kind of sick humor in them, so...
Lotano has been working with Popler for 7 years, and together they selected materials and color concepts from Lotano's work that would enhance the showcase with quirky details.
I chose the pieces that are a little bit lighter. Because I work with a lot of found objects, they tend to be dark, and especially in East Germany, they painted everything brown or gray. And so I tried to pick out the pieces that would have more color to them and that have a little bit of whimsy in them, because everything else is so serious. What excited me about showing my stuff here in this context is that people can see my artwork with a setup like an apartment or a living room. Here, I have a chance to show it, that this could live with you, could become part of your life, you know.
All design pieces are for sale and will be on display at Wallstrasse's grand showroom until September 22nd. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Not many can boast of being a certified arborist and furniture designer at the same time, besides Joel Harrison-Off. When he's not busy helping the city of Toronto protect its greenery from ever-present threats of invasive plants, pollution and vandalism, he's designing and crafting new furniture. It's a skill he picked up at Sheridan College in Toronto. His forthcoming installation, Cambium at Made, explores the muscle-like anatomy of the Eastern White Cedar, which he debarks, splits, and lights from within. Joel discusses how he brings his love for wooden design in his furniture with Monocle's Jason Lee in Toronto's Don Valley.
We are at the Evergreen Brickworks, located sort of in the Don Valley system in downtown Toronto, or near downtown Toronto. For me, this is a place that has blended a lot of the work I've done with the city and on my own. I've been lucky enough to participate in some of the installation work here. I've made some benches, and my work with the City of Toronto and forestry has allowed me to explore the ravine system and forest all around the brickworks.
So how does your arborist background inform your design aesthetic?
I'm very much influenced by the wood itself, the form of the trees. I think because I get right in there and am cutting the wood down, I see where it's coming from. I see what the tree was like. I have a real sense of sort of the strength of the material, how the material is going to be worked, the flow of the grain, I think really influences the end product. My stuff tends to be very related to the tree form itself, but has a modern influence, definitely an imposed hand sort of influence that lets you know that it's been worked, but it's still retaining some of that natural flavor, I guess.
And it's pretty functional too, like you're sitting on one of your works. Can you describe what we're sitting on?
We are sitting on two benches that I made last year for the Brickworks. They're called slash piles. They were influenced by my work as a tree planter up north. Basically, when you're up there, you see what the logging has done, and after it's been clear cut, there's these piles of slash, which is just off-cut limbs that they can't use, and they just push them into these big piles. I got into the idea of thinking, okay, well, let's try and use that for something. How do you do it? I tried to clamp it all together as tightly as possible to form basically a larger tree, but made up of lots of little pieces, and then carved into two seats into it. So practical, but still has a bit of a statement and aesthetically eye-catching.
So talking about public art, you're also exhibiting at MADE in Toronto.
This show at MADE called Cambium has finally come about after a lot of poking and prodding and timing. I've always wanted to do something in their cooler gallery, but just haven't had the chance. Finally has come about, and I had a couple pieces of wood that I had cut down almost a year ago now that I thought would fit the space nicely. And they were kind enough to give me a good time slot in the summer coming up here. The gallery is a small little cooler. It used to be an old grocery store, so I guess they would have kept their small items in there to keep them cool. So it's dark, small, and I really wanted to take something from the outside that was very organic looking and make it seem like it had grown inside of that cooler. The pieces themselves are white cedar that have been debarked and hollowed out and then split in half along the grain itself. So not straight lines, but very curvy. Inside, I've built sort of a lighting structure. So the idea, you walk into the cooler, you'll be right into it right away because it's so small. And these sort of eerie, organic, tree-like shapes will be glowing from within. So it's kind of an eerie, organic feel, but still hinting at functional lighting.
Would you say that the general trajectory of your career so far has been to move away from furniture more and more into the artistic side of design?
I would say it's a tough call because, you know, a lot of furniture becomes art depending on who you're talking to. I don't consider myself an artist per se. I'd like to hold on to a lot of the practical things that I associate with furniture. But yeah, for sure, lately because I have the chance and the opportunity, a lot of my pieces tend to be more sculptural, eye-catching, and in public places where you would expect to see art rather than furniture.
So what's more important to you as a furniture designer, functionality or the aesthetic?
First and foremost, I like to anchor my pieces in something practical, some sort of use for people. So that comes first. I think the aesthetics, you want it to be interesting. I mean, you just don't want something plain and practical. It just happens. And again, the materials I'm using tend to lend themselves to an aesthetic value, and I can't really ignore that when I'm working on them. There is that sculptural side to things and that artistic eye that I try to apply to my work. But again, I try to anchor it in a function, you know, first and foremost.
So is there a conflict of interest? Because as an arborist, you're protecting trees and you're saving trees. And as a designer, a maker, a craftsman of wood, you very often have to maybe cut down trees. Do you see that as a conflict, and how do you reconcile the two?
I think it's become a conflict only in the sense where we've been forced to cut down trees. But like you said, the arborist work itself, I try to do techniques, removing limbs from trees that will not essentially kill the tree, but will help it in the long run, especially in urban settings. The inevitable byproduct of that is there's a lot of wood floating around in urban areas, especially in the city of Toronto. There's a lot of issues right now with trees. So instead of a large, you know, glut of wood that's just going to be chipped or thrown out, I see it as a benefit to be able to somehow use it and make it into something that might be visually interesting and practical.
So talking about the Canadian and the Toronto design landscape, what are some of the major trends do you see as a Canadian Toronto designer?
I would hate to say I'm on the cusp of design, but I definitely see the influence of very rustic, heavy pieces of wood, natural looking things in the city of Toronto, especially in the design scene right now. I think because there's the general disconnect with urban life and the natural world, people would like to see more of that in their home settings. I would too, and I think that's my reaction to living in the urban area. Just I like to see the juxtaposition between, you know, a lot of industrial looking things and that natural world. And luckily I happen to have an aesthetic and an interest that fits in right now with the city of Toronto and a lot of Canadian design right now.
That was Joel Harrison-Off speaking to Monocle's Jason Lee in Toronto. Still to come in part two, we find out how we'll soon be filling our living rooms with old Chinese signs, plastic sieves and bamboo sticks. But first, we're off to the New York office of creative agency Mother. To make great work, have fun, and make money. Always in that order. That's the official motto of Mother, the UK's largest independent creative agency. Founded in 1996, Mother quickly grew outside of Britain and opened offices in Buenos Aires in New York, where our America's Bureau Chief Santiago Tarditi interviewed the creative director Michael Ian Kay. They discussed the agency's latest projects, including a white whiskey distilled not too far from their offices.
Creating a design agency within an advertising agency is no small feat. We are both designers and advertising people, are both ambitious and want to make things and put things out into the world. I think designers are schooled with the intent on what they make lasting forever. Advertising folk are schooled with the intent on creating something that causes an immediate reaction. And those two things can be at odds with each other. And my ambition with this group was to demonstrate that design can create advertising that's much more long-term, and that advertising can use design in a way that they hadn't in the past.
Besides working with big accounts, Mother also takes time to develop its own projects. One of those is the White Pike Whiskey, a spirit that's distilled in the New York State. How was the experience of working both as an agency and a client, and what reception or reviews has the whiskey received so far?
One, working on your own projects is quite liberating in many ways. You have creative freedom to create not only the product, the liquid in this case, but the packaging and all of the communications that surround it. I think that you're continually questioning yourself based on the experience that you've had working with other clients, larger clients, making sure that you're living up to the expectations that you would want your client to be living up to in those circumstances. I think the challenges are we've got a lot of other projects going on, and internal projects tend to take a back seat. So maintaining momentum over, I think, the 3 years it actually took to develop the liquid, the bottle and the packaging, and kind of our strategy for getting it out into the world, it feels like a pretty long time, but it's because it can't be anybody's kind of pure focus because everybody's working on so many things. I think that we did it slow and we did it our way, though, and I think there's a real sense of pride that comes from that. And we brought people in-house to help us with kind of marketing and sales strategy so that we were actually selling the liquid door to door by ourselves. We were finding the right doors in the city where we wanted to be, associating with the right, you know, kinds of venues, chefs, etc., and making sure that it went out into the market with, again, I guess, a certain integrity. And to date, we're probably in maybe 100 doors in the city. We only secured the rights to distribute it in New York State. We wanted to start small, and we've just kind of, I think, inked a deal for larger distribution. So the challenges are actually getting it done, having an idea, and sticking with it, and making sure that kind of it just doesn't fall by the wayside. And I think there was a lot of passion around this project. And when there's passion, these things tend to just move.
Another great project you have is the Mother Talks. How did this start, and who has participated?
Mother Talks started because we're an agency who's obviously kind of quite engaged in our clients' business, but kind of are always thirsty to be exposed to who's doing what out in the world culturally. We want to stimulate ourselves both from a visual space, from an intellectual space, from a marketing space. And so on a quarterly to trimesterly, if that's a word, three times a year, basis, we bring in somebody to do a slide talk, somebody to kind of speak to us about what's going on kind of in their worlds. And we have a set of bleachers downstairs, high school bleachers, and we just pull them out. We set up a table up front. I've actually moderated a few of those panels. We've had Todd Oldham has come in here for the launch of the Alexander Girard book that he did, and he gave a great lecture about the amazingness of Alexander Girard. If you haven't seen that book, you should check it out. And we've had Todd Selby come in for the launch of his book. He did a great book where he traveled the world kind of speaking and documenting all of these people who are doing kind of really, really cool things around food. And so we actually did an exhibition of his work in what we call the Peanut Gallery, and he came in to do a great talk.
And finally, Michael, where do you find inspiration, and has it changed throughout your career?
Personally, I find inspiration, this is going to sound cliche, but everywhere. I had a kind of more of a fine art background. A large part of that was really art history, and I always look quite deeply kind of at the cultural artifacts that are made, you know, throughout time to understand the layers of communication. And so I'm obsessed with, you know, Renaissance painting and the kind of structure behind Renaissance painting. At the same time, I'm inspired by performance art, theater, film. I'm a culture grabber, and I think that although we do graphic design, it really helps to have multiple points of interest, because I'm not trying to perpetuate a certain style or develop kind of a certain look for everything that we do. I want our look to be, or I want what we do to be a response to what's happening either in culture today or the thinking that's happened in the making of things throughout time.
That was Michael Ian Kay speaking to Monocle's Santiago Tarditi in New York. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. After this interlude, we'll be hearing how one Hong Kong design firm has been making do and mending old tat found in the city for a new range of furniture.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. One of Hong Kong's most unconventional design firms is Yan Yung, based in one of the oldest and poorest neighbourhoods in the city. The company seeks to make use of everyday objects that play to the city's history. Old Chinese signs, plastic sieves and bamboo sticks are just a few examples of items that have been repurposed or added to other materials to make unique pieces of design and furniture. Yan Yung aims to bring furniture with a taste of old Hong Kong to the design forefront. Vivian Liu reports.
It started last year in July. We launched in the DMY Festival in Berlin with the other designers from Ambassador of Design. So that's how we started. I think this is one of the oldest neighborhoods in Hong Kong. So it has like a very long history and culture, and it's a very rich mix of people and craftsmen and manufacturers and materials. So we've got a lot of things going on here, but people just don't really notice. So this is, we call it Tong Lao. Basically, it's Chinese tenement building, we call it. And the character is the windows at the front. They've got really big L-shaped windows and high ceiling. And the original floor tiles were made on site. So they're like all custom made, these kind of ceramic tiles that people don't make them anymore. It's a walk-up building, unfortunately, but I think that's the character of Tong Lao as well.
Patricia and Dennis have created many pieces in the past in their concept of Yun Yang, but each designer has a personal favorite.
The first piece I made for Yun Yang was the tangram. It's a series of furnitures based on the Chinese tangram. Dennis did a sign shelf, which was based on some shops which were closing down. And he turned the signs and the shelves that he picked up into like installation. And Shoss is lighting designer. He makes a lot of special feature lights with found objects as well, but mainly with metal and timber. I saw his sign shelves picture and then I just felt, okay, this guy, I really need this guy to work with me. So we we found each other, and then we talk about how we should name the brand and what we want to do, and then we came up with the name Yun Yang because we're quite different as well. So it's like milk tea mixes with coffee. It's this completely kind of weird taste, but very authentic Hong Kong.
In a tour around Yun Yang showroom, Patricia pointed out a couple of her favorite pieces to me.
It's from the 1960s. It's a Danish brand, but it was made in Japan. So everything's still in very good condition, you see, like how it goes back, goes up, how it turns. And then when you switch it off, it still has that ting sound. This is like a little lamp that we use, made from like a Kowloon Dairy milk bottle that everyone is familiar with in Hong Kong. Turn it into a light.
In a city where money comes first, Patricia and Dennis's dedication to preserving local culture is hard to find.
Do you think you have a specific design philosophy?
We're trying to find beauty and or aesthetic from things that people often ignore. It's so easy to make beautiful things or from scratch, but you know, we want to see the values that people often ignore. I think this is more important for us than, you know, just making another very nice chair.
Patricia and Dennis plan to continue Yun Yuen's work with an upcoming installation space done in collaboration with the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Yun Yuen puts a new twist on traditional Hong Kong design as a refreshing newcomer to the design scene.
That was Vivian Liu reporting from Hong Kong. It's a fact of the business that very few architects spend time getting their hands dirty, with sitting behind drawing boards preferred to on-site expertise. To address this gap, Scotsman Michael Holliday and a group of recent architectural graduates have launched a live build studio in Scotland that has attracted students from all over the world who want a closer understanding of the physicality of building. Monocle's Zoe Tennant met with Michael Holliday to discuss the work of Togg Studio and the unwavering importance of hammers and saws in an increasingly digitised profession.
I think it's important for architecture students to be able to understand how buildings go together, what's involved in making a frame, how heavy a piece of wood is, what it smells like, what it looks like when you cut it against the grain, what it looks like when you work with it with the grain. All of these things mean that as you learn what's involved in far more detail, and you can then feed that understanding back into your design work and become a better architect because of it.
That's architect Michael Holliday, and he says the growing gap between digital design and the craft of building impacts how architects think and work. To address this gap, Holliday and a team of young architects launched Togg Studio, a live-build summer studio on a remote Scottish island. Togg is in its second year and has already won 2 design awards and is currently the focus of an exhibit at the Lighthouse, Glasgow Centre for Design and Architecture. The second studio, like the first, sold out and attracted international participants. It recently wrapped up on the shores of the Isle of Tiree, the most westerly of the Inner Hebrides. I met with Michael in his Glasgow studio.
While I was studying architecture, there was a real emphasis on flashy graphics and the latest computer systems, which always felt a little bit alienating. I often felt that this was at the expense of a real detailed understanding of what's involved in building. My summer jobs had involved labouring on a building site, and I soon realised that there was this chasm, this disconnection between what people in the real world who were delivering buildings were doing and what we were being taught back at school. Togg Studio grew out of that disconnection. We realised that it wasn't just us that felt this way. We were inspired to create the studio after a visit to Ghost Lab in Nova Scotia, which is a world-famous programme where an architect, Brian McKay-Lyons, has students visit his farm every summer to build a little 2-week-long wooden structure. This has been running for years. We visited it in its 13th year, and so his whole farm is an essay of beautiful little buildings and pavilions and houses that have been accumulated over these years. We came back from that and said, there needs to be one of these in Scotland, and if nobody else is going to do it, then we're going to have to do it ourselves.
Okay, and now we do a similar exercise on this side, just to see where we are for vertical that
That's way. The sound of a team of architectural students, young architects, and lecturers creating a timber frame at the Togg Live Build Summer Studio. Emily Stephen is entering her 5th year of architecture school at the University of Strathclyde, and she attended Togg Studio this summer. I caught up with her in Glasgow.
You could say perhaps a typical day might be you would set up in the morning with maybe divide it into a team with the people that are all there. So you might be on something like constructing the bracing for one side of the boathouse. So you would, if the frame was already up, for example, that day, you would be going over to the frame, you'd be measuring yourself with your team. Perhaps you would have one person with you, measuring from the timbers that are already there, what you're going to need to do, going and finding the wood that would be over in the pile, getting the right sizes and sewing them down. Then you would be going over probably with the same team members to check that what you've got actually fits in there. Again, just understanding the wood, slotting it in, probably at that stage drilling everything in, and then standing back to check how it all looks and moving on to the next bay. And it would be a series of those sorts of things in the morning.
Good to go? Yep. We've spoken about architectural education. Maybe you could just describe to me a little bit more what your architectural education has been like, what ways Live Build has or hasn't featured in your formal education.
We got a very small amount of Live Build in first year, which everyone was actually very interested in, and there was a great enthusiasm for it. But at Strathclyde, there isn't really the opportunity to do any more of that in the final few years, which is a little bit sad because I think the more you progress in the education, the more important it is to actually stop it being just about drawings and images and bring it back to real life. It is actual real buildings we are putting up. These are not just drawings. So I think there is a disconnect between probably architects as well as students in the bigger giant practices where you just aren't really seeing these things in real life. There are people just sitting in offices drawing this. And, you know, you can really lose a sense of what you're actually doing.
Tog Studio was inspired by Ghost Lab, a world-famous and award-winning Canadian live-build studio founded by Brian McKay Lyons. Brian is an architect and professor at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, and he's found a way to incorporate live-build into the school's curriculum. I reached Brian at his office in Halifax.
I started Ghost Lab in 1994 as a young professor and practitioner because I was frustrated both with architectural education and the direction it was going, and architectural practice, education more so. There seemed to be a gap, a gulf, really, between the world of the academy and the world of practice, or the world of ideas and the world of things.
And what were you hoping Ghost Lab would address?
Well, to create an idea in the minds of the students that those two worlds were really all part of one world. And I know that young people decide to be architects because they're interested in making things. And so I wanted to achieve the result, I guess, that people realize that architecture is about the land and it's about making and it's about community. And it's a team sport. It's something you do with other people. And people know that, I think, when they go into architecture, and unfortunately in architectural school, some of that gets untaught.
Ghost Lab grew into something called Free Lab that is now integral to architectural education at Dalhousie University.
Every summer now, Dalhousie has a Free Lab mode of education that happens. And people go out and do design build projects. And everyone in the school now does that. And it's a long-standing tradition at Dal now. And I think it's one of the things that distinguishes the school at Dalhousie is that it has this kind of design build or hands-on learning part of the curriculum.
What are your hopes for the future of architecture education?
I have hopes for the unity of architectural education, the unity of architecture, that design build was a way for us to make the point that the world of ideas and the world of things, or the head and the hand, are all part of one thing, and there needs to be an integrated view. And design build is really a tactic to get that point across.
And then see how high you can reach.
For Monocle, in Glasgow, I'm Zoe Tennant.
And that concludes today's edition of Section D. My producer was Aled John, and the show was edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com with any thoughts or feedback. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, here's a favourite from one of my favourites, Tori Amos, who celebrated her 50th birthday last week. This is A Sort of Fairy Tale. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.